Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today, we spend the entire hour talking about Troy Anthony Davis and the fight against capital punishment.
Back in September of 2011, a grotesque, savage crime was committed when the state of Georgia executed Troy Davis. Troy Anthony Davis was an innocent man, an innocent black man who had been framed, pushed through, railroaded through an entire process that constantly was based on just, I think, was a concentration of what happens to many, many people in this society, in this country, under this system, and in particular, what happens to black people in this country and under this system. And Troy was also somebody who never caved in to either self-pity or whatever. He was somebody who, from the very moment this happened to him, vowed to fight to prove his innocence and vowed to fight not only for himself, but for everyone else who was facing this kind of situation, both in society at large and on death row, as well as in the prisons. And a little while ago, someone I met a number of years ago was the co-author of a book that just hit me in the head very, very hard. The book is called I Am Troy Davis, and it's written by Jen Marlowe, together with Martina Davis Correa, and along with contributions by Troy Anthony Davis himself. And I have to tell you, this book is an extremely, extremely powerful book. It's something that brought me not just to the edge of tears, but to tears many times in the book, and oftentimes in between bouts of just sputtering rage. Knowing the situation with Troy Davis, I didn't know as much as I thought I did. And knowing it, I also, the power of this book is that it really brings you inside the whole struggle. It brings you inside of Troy Davis's life for an extensive period of time. And you see, you find yourself sitting there thinking, okay, there's no way they can go ahead with this, even though you know they did, in fact, go ahead with this towering crime. So joining us to talk about this today is Jen Marlowe. Jen, thank you very much for showing up today.
Thanks, Michael. It's always great to be on your show.
And I'm very pleased to welcome Kimberly Davis, who is Troy Anthony Davis's sister. Kimberly, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into one thing right away. Can you give people, maybe, and both of you can speak to this, but Jen, why don't you go first? A lot of people know somewhat about Troy and what happened to him, but we're also now 3 years down, and there's a lot of people who, you know, in this society, so many things keep piling up, and people who either didn't know or may not have known as much as we might assume they knew. So can you tell people about Troy Davis?
Sure. And talking about who Troy was as a human being, of course, is a much bigger question. But in terms of what happened in Troy's case, Troy was convicted in 1991 for the murder of a white police officer in Savannah, Georgia. Troy's a African-American, or at that time was a young 20-year-old African-American young man. And at the time that he was convicted, the case against him was based entirely on witness testimony. There was never any physical evidence that linked Troy to the murder. So the case was all around eyewitness testimonies. And then later, after Troy was convicted, the vast majority of those witnesses came forward saying that, recanting their testimony and saying that they had falsely implicated Troy, many of them saying that they had been pressured or coerced or intimidated by the police into giving that false testimony. Other witnesses came forward and said, actually, we know who did it. This other person, whose name was Sylvester Red Coles, that this man had confessed to them that he had done it. Other witnesses came forward and saying they actually saw Red Coles pull the trigger. Red Coles himself was one of the two witnesses who didn't recant, and he was actually the same person who had given Troy's name to the police the evening following the murder. And so what we found is that whatever flimsy case the state had against Troy at trial, post-trial, post-conviction, that case disintegrated entirely. It completely unraveled. The whole case was based on these witnesses. Once those witnesses recanted their testimony, there was no evidence linking Troy to this murder whatsoever. In fact, there became a growing mountain of evidence pointing to Troy's innocence. And yet the state of Georgia was still just determined, you described it very well in your introduction, just to railroad Troy to the conclusion that that they felt needed to happen, which was making sure that someone paid for the murder of this police officer, and not being willing to step back and say, we were wrong, we made a mistake, possibly because they felt that if they did that, they might get no conviction. So perhaps in their mind, getting any conviction was better than no conviction. And so there were ups and downs and twists and turns and a lot of struggle. But in the end, the state of Georgia did execute Troy on September 21st, 2011. But at that point, there were hundreds of thousands of people worldwide watching in shock and in horror, understanding perhaps for the first time the criminality of our criminal justice system.
Very well put. You know, Kimberly, when you think about it, when I read the book and when I looked at what had been done in the immediate aftermath and in a way all the way through to the execution, there was never a moment that somehow the powers that be didn't try to dehumanize and criminalize Troy at every step of the way. I mean, the dehumanization from the very beginning, it really put you in mind of, you know, runaway slaves in the South in the 1800s, in terms of the way that this was like just thrown out there. And it was this savage kind of relentless, not just pursuit, but characterization of your brother as, this man is not a man. He is an animal who would commit brutal acts. Because I think the book really paints an entirely different picture. And I am so, so moved by that and so happy that it does that, where your brother's humanity really comes out. Your entire family's humanity comes out. But tell people on the human side, who was your brother? What was he like?
Well, my brother Troy Davis was actually a loving figure to me and my family. Me, Martina, and Troy, we actually went to high school together. And, you know, I was following in my sister and brother's footsteps ever since we were actually in elementary school. And they were saying, you know, the Davis 2, which was Martina and Troy, and then the Davis 3, you know, when I came along. And also, you know, with Troy, I was actually paralyzed at the age of 15. And I know when I was paralyzed, my brother actually disenrolled himself out of high school only to be able to help my mother with me and my other siblings. And my mother did not know that he had actually disenrolled himself out of high school only to enroll himself in school at night. He was going to school at night and then working during the day. And when I was 15, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and I was actually totally paralyzed. Doctors told my mother that I would not see my 16th birthday. And if it wasn't for my brother with his faith and determination, and my mom always kept me and my family in church, we always went to church together. But I gave up a long time ago when the doctor told me that I would never be able to walk again. My brother asked me, where is your faith? Where is that faith that you always said you had? You know, God is here for you. And he said, you can't give up on yourself. You can't give up on God. My brother used to take me to physical therapy 5 days a week. And then when I started going back to school, I couldn't go to my regular school that I was going to. I had to go to a special school. So he would take me to physical therapy in the morning and then take me to school. And so my brother actually put his life on hold in order to help me. And when I graduated in 1988, my brother, I told him that I wanted to be able to walk across the stage when I graduated. And he actually, you know, helped me prepare to walk across the stage when I went back to school. 5 months before I graduated, I was actually pushing my wheelchair around the school. And I can remember when I did graduate and I walked across the stage, I actually walked across the stage. I was not in the wheelchair. I walked across the stage. And when I got to the end of the stage, my brother was actually at the end of the stage. And I presented my high school diploma to my brother, because if it wasn't for him, I don't think that I would even been able to walk across that stage, because I had just given up on myself. But he had faith and determination, and he pushed me to where I needed to be.
That actually is one of the parts in the book that really, there was one, it was sort of like, oh, wow, are you, wait a minute. and especially the point about, you're a basketball player. Mm-hmm. Here, come on. And you're like, what are you crazy? I'm not, no, how mean can you get? But the point of actually I thought it was really a point where you see the strength of character in a person who not only cares a lot about you, your family, but by extension, you can extend that out to the relations that you learn about his relationship with other humans in the course of this book. But it was really, really inspiring in terms of the way that he actually took responsibility and didn't cave in to a lot of the kind of what happens when people get sick, when people, there's a usually a lot of pity, usually a lot of, well, it's too bad. But your brother actually said, no, you are going to step out and be a full participant in society.
Yes.
And you certainly are that today.
Yes.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Kimberly Davis and Jen Marlowe. And Jen is the co-author, along with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Davis, of the book I Am Troy Davis, and it's about the case of Troy Davis and the fight against capital punishment. And Kimberly is Troy's sister. Jen, you say in the beginning of the book that this was probably one of the most difficult tasks you've ever undertaken. And, you know, just being somewhat familiar with some of the work that you've done, and I was told, we were talking earlier about that film of the family that in Gaza, and knowing, you know, again, the power of that and how difficult I have to assume that was. When you said this was one of the most difficult tasks you may have undertaken, writing this book was one of the most difficult tasks, explain that.
Well, it was difficult and painful in, there was different levels of that. One of the levels was, emotionally difficult. This was never a project, quote unquote. This was never, you know, a book that I was writing that was, you know, a project. This was something I was doing because I had a very close relationship with Troy, with Martina, and with the entire family, you know, as the years went on. And writing the book was my way of trying to do something for them and something for the cause that they were fighting for. And so I was not an outside journalist coming in and doing research and things like that. I was someone who loved this family, still does love this family, and so I was immersed in the pain and in the trauma of a family that I love deeply. And you know, most of the book ended up getting finished after Troy's execution, and then Martina passed away 2 months after Troy. We worked on the book before that, but so much of the urgent work in the years leading up to the execution was about trying to prevent the execution. The book itself was sort of this long-term project that we all wanted to see happen, but wasn't as important as the immediate task of trying to prevent this atrocity from happening. But once the execution did happen, and Troy's final letter to Martina, written, postmarked the day he was killed, urged her to finish writing the book. Mm-hmm. And Martina was fighting for her own life at that point as well. She had been very, very ill and had essentially busted out of the hospital to be there with and for Troy in those final days. So Martina called me the day she opened up Troy's final letter and said, okay, finishing this book is now the most important thing that I want to do. And I think she knew that she had limited time left on Earth. She ended up having about 2 months, and we spent a lot of those 2 months working on the book. And then Martina passed. And so then I had the task of taking, because none of the writing had happened at that point. We had gathered all the material. We had done all that part of the work. So then I had the task to take that and to make sure that their book happened. And I went from Martina's funeral in Savannah, and I asked Kim and I asked the family, do you still want this book to go forward? And they said, yes, that's what Martina wanted. That's what Troy wanted. So that's what we want. So I said, okay, those are my marching orders. And I went into 3 months of isolation so that I could just dive right in. And it was really painful diving into the fresh trauma of people who I loved so dearly and trying to immerse myself in that and then create something from that that would honor them. Mm-hmm. And that would honor the sacred promise that I had made to them. So in all those ways, it was very painful, and you know, and Kim and I would talk a lot during those times, and the whole family was helping me, and all these different people, but everyone was going through the pain of all that loss, and their mom died 4 months before Troy was executed. So it was Troy, it was Martina, and it was Mama, all within 6 months of each other. Mm. And there was another piece of that difficulty, which is completing a manuscript when both of your co-authors were gone. So I couldn't go back to Martina and said, hey, in our interview that we did last year, you said this. Can you tell me more about this? And I couldn't write a letter to Troy saying, can you share with me more memories about X, Y, and Z? They were gone, and there were gaps. And so I had to find other ways to fill those gaps. And many, many other people who were close to the family and Troy's attorneys and lots of people were absolutely instrumental in helping me fill those gaps. Most of all, of course, Kimberly Davis. And we spent hours and hours texting and talking and to help correct things. But none of that is quite the same as the co-authors. If it was Martina's private thoughts. Kim was very, very close to her sister, but Kim can't be inside her sister's head, right? And so there was that difficulty as well of how to complete the manuscript when it was Troy and Martina's book, and they weren't there anymore.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Kimberly Davis and Jen Marlowe. And Jen is the co-author, along with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Davis, of the book I Am Troy Davis, and it's about the case of Troy Davis and the fight against capital punishment. And Kimberly is Troy's sister. I'd like to have you read a piece of the book before we move on, because there's a number of other questions I want to get into about the case in particular and some of the things that you bring out. But I'd like to have you just give people a taste of what the book is like.
I'm going to read a passage that's from the very end of the first part of the book. And the book is structured essentially around these four execution dates. There's four parts of the book, and each part of the book is structured around one of the execution dates. And then there's different kinds of flashback that happen in each section. You know, I think one of the lessons we learn from Troy's story and from the Davis family struggle is not, again, it's not just that there was so much injustice and so much tragedy, but there was also so much strength and resilience. And in fact, there was a lot of triumph. And even though the ending of what happened to their family is so tragic, it's also a part of the triumph, because in the effort to bring down the death penalty, we're winning that fight. And Troy and Martina are a big part of the reason why. So there's triumph in that. And so I want to read a part of the book that came from the first execution date, which was in 2007. And this was 23 hours before Georgia had scheduled to kill Troy Anthony Davis. And the family was waiting in their hotel room in Atlanta after the clemency hearing had happened in front of the parole board. And they were waiting to see what was going to happen. Was this execution going to go forward, or was it going to be stopped? And it was July 16th, 2007. An unfamiliar number appeared on Martina's caller ID at 8 p.m. Hello? Martina? Yes? This is the New York Times. How do you feel? How do I feel about what? About Troy's stay. What stay? The parole board gave Troy a 90-day stay of execution. Martina threw the phone down and began to leap around the hotel room. Troy got a stay! Troy got a stay! She screamed. Just then, Mama's cell phone rang. Virginia punched through the numbers as quickly as she could so that she could hear Troy's voice. Hi, Mama. How'd the hearing go? Virginia put her cell phone on speaker so Troy could hear Martina, who was still dancing and shouting. You hear that, honey? The family huddled around Virginia's cell phone to hear Troy's reaction. For a moment, there was silence. Then, an almost inaudible, "Thank you, God," followed by another, "Thank you, God," this time a little louder. Troy did something he did regularly. Troy prayed. Then he did something he almost never did. Troy began to cry. Warden Terry verified the news of the stay, and two guards led Troy from the death house back to his cell block. Fellow death row inmates lined up at the doors of their cells, extending their arms through the iron bars to grasp Troy's hand as he walked down the row. "Praise God, brother," one man called out to him, tears in his eyes. "Maybe at least one of us will survive this place," another cheered. Troy's friends shoved small items through the bars for him to take back, items that Troy had bequeathed to them the previous day. A bottle of shampoo, some extra stamps, a few envelopes, his belt and shoes. Troy, head high and a new spring in his step, walked into his cell. He heard the familiar clank of the cell door locking behind him, but at that moment he was not focused on his confinement. He was focused on his life. Georgia had intended to take it from him in less than 24 hours. He and his family and scores of supporters had fought, and they had prevailed.
Thank you very much. So, Kimberly, how would you like to read a passage from the book as well?
I would love to. This passage is coming from December 1993. Troy had never intended to make friends on death row, but there was something disarming about Chris Berger. Chris was tall, trim, strong, and gave off a tough demeanor, but showed warmth and affection to his friends. He sketched beautifully with color pencils, often sending his drawings to his mother, to whom he was devoted. He was older than Troy by more than 10 years, but there was something... Sorry.
That's all right.
But there was something vulnerable and childlike about him. Perhaps screaming his history and severe childhood abuse. Chris has been only 17 years old when he had participated in the murder of Roger Honeycutt. His execution date was set for December 7th, 1993. He confessed to Troy how frightening he was. Troy saw the guards parading Chris back and forth in front of the death row inmates on the evening of December 7th before leading him to the execution chamber to strap him into the electric chair. Troy sat in his cell, hunched over on his bed, waiting for the horrifying moment when the lights would flicker, indicating that a high current of electricity was coursing through Chris's body. Every man on the row twitched with silent agony when the flickering began at 9:50. Troy kneeled on the hard floor, gripping the steel frame of his bed tightly, and prayed for his friend. Only later did he learn that Berger's last words was an apology to everyone he had ever hurt and pleaded for forgiveness. One of the guards who had prayed at Chris in front of Troy's cell said, "Hey, Davis." Troy heard the guard, and he said, "Yeah." Troy looked up. "How'd you like some fries to go at that burger?" Troy resolved never to become so quite close to anyone else on death row again. You know, this passage here, it was just, you know, just so profounding because of all the gentlemen that we actually met on death row during the time that my brother was there. Like Troy said, he didn't want to grow closer to anyone else after Chris Berger's execution. But our family grew so close to so many of the guys that were on death row. My nephew, Dejan, you know, a couple of the guys on death row, they called him their nephew. Dejan called one of the guys on death row his, used to call him, you know, his grandpa because he was a little bit older. And it was like our family had a connection not only with Troy, but also with so many of the other guys that were on death row. And they, you know, they told us that they would have loved to have a sister like Martina in a family like our family because they said that, you know, our family, it seemed like we had just so much love to give, not only to Troy, but so much love to give to the other guys on death row. And our love didn't stop only with Troy. The death penalty fight didn't stop only with Troy. It didn't begin only with Troy. And we actually tried to reach out to anyone that came in our paths that we were able to help. And we're still continuing to reach out to anyone in our paths.
And thank you very much for that. I know it was difficult, but it was very powerful reading. And your remarks afterwards are extremely powerful as well. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Kimberly Davis and Jen Marlowe. And Jen is the co-author, along with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Davis, of the book I Am Troy Davis. And it's about the case of Troy Davis and the fight against capital punishment. And Kimberly is Troy's sister. You know, one of the things I wanted to get back to was the kind of the dehumanization that we started out talking about. And right after they were actually where his name was given to the police as this is the person that did it. What you saw unleashed there was just this phenomenally savage racist wave. And can you tell us a little bit about that, Jen? Because that's something I didn't know about. And Kimberly, if you can add things to it, I'll give you a chance to recover though a little, but you know, if you can tell us about that, because this is one of the things I think a lot of people don't know. Like, what was the atmosphere there? What happened? You know, it reminds you of the kinds of pogroms that happened so often in this country, and especially to black people, but then also throughout the world. And it was really just this hysteria that built up that was amazing and disgusting and threatening.
Absolutely. And Kimberly can talk about it also from her own memories and her own personal experience of living that. But from the research that I did and talking to Martina and to Troy, it was really once Sylvester Coles gave Troy's name to the police and they surrounded the house and they legally took a photograph without a warrant from the house, as well as some other things. And then it was like this manhunt for Troy began, but it began It was as if racial tensions that Savannah always had, of course, it's not that those ever went away, but they had been maybe a little more underground. Now they just exploded. And basically the search for Troy became a rampage through all the black neighborhoods, grabbing up any, you know, what I was told was that any young black male between the ages of 15 to 50 wasn't safe. Every young black male was getting slammed on the sidewalk, slammed against the wall. They were just looking for Troy, and anyone who looked like Troy and anyone who could possibly vaguely slightly resemble Troy was getting slammed against the sidewalk and beaten and kicked around. And it wasn't just, oh, you're not Troy, okay, go along and have a nice day, sir. There was a revenge and a wrath, because you have to remember it was a police officer who was killed, and so the same police forces who had lost one of their own was essentially taking all their rage and all their anger out on the young male black community and whipping up white Savannah into fear that there was this monster on the loose, and you know, and so all of the racial tensions, all of the racial dividing lines that had always existed were just inflamed in that moment and continued in many ways for years and years.
Well, you know, when you look at it, part of the thing too, where they as I read in the book, where they issued a shoot to kill, that kind of order coming out and then publicizing that. This is part of that whole dehumanization and criminalization mm-hmm. that I was talking about. And then you're talking about it as it goes out to every young black man in the entire area. There was a point that was just so, it captured something about your brother, Kimberly, but it also concentrated something about this whole pogromish atmosphere that they had whipped up. When your brother, it's funny, somebody said to me, well, didn't anybody take a minute to say, well, why did he come back? For people who haven't read the book, don't know the case, he had gone to Atlanta to find a job. And when he found out what was going on, he said, I'll go back and prove to them that I didn't do it. I'll just tell them I didn't do it.
It's interesting you picked up on that point, because the prosecution always likes to say that the fact that Troy went to Atlanta to them is proof that he was guilty. In their spinning of the events, he fled to Atlanta after the crime. What they never seem to mention when they say that is he voluntarily returned to Savannah to walk into the police station when he knew that there was a manhunt for him. He said, I will come back. I will turn myself in. I will explain that I didn't do it, and trusting that that would mean everything would be okay. So if Troy had fled because he had committed a terrible murder, why would he not have kept fleeing?
Right. And what they did too, when they finally did all the booking and everything else, and they brought him out, and there were all these cops out there, and he walks through this sort of this harassment line where they're basically, you know, they could use their clubs and beat him down there. You had the sense that they would certainly have done it. And they kept taunting him with these racist taunts. But then when he decided that he would look, and he looked, and there's all this press, and he smiled. And the smile, as you point out, it was a smile of, I won't let them beat me down. But what it got portrayed as, look, he's smirking. He's like, yeah, he's like mocking everything that we stand for.
And I think that was one of their first lessons that the family had, that no matter what they did or how they presented himself, the media was going to be able to twist it to serve whatever agenda they had.
Right, exactly. Kimberly, what do you remember about that time? Because the one thing that happened is that your house was surrounded and raided. Can you tell people what you remember about the time when they were searching for your brother?
Well, I can remember, you know, coming back to the house, and we could not even, you know, get to our street. At the end of our street, you know, it was just like police officers. They were on rooftops of our neighbors' houses. They were all in the yards of the neighbors. It looked like something that was just unreal, you know, with all of the police presence that was even there. And then you talked about, you know, when Troy came back home, and when he actually volunteered to come back home, it was actually supposed to be a secret meeting with Reverend LeBon, who was actually a police chaplain, and one of the other officers that were actually, you know, supposed to be bringing him back in. And when we actually went to the neighborhood where Reverend LeBon lived, like I said, it was just supposed to be something private. But you saw it was just, you know, too conspicuous, because, I mean, you saw people walking outside in the summertime with long trench coats. I mean, you just saw people sitting on benches with long trench coats, black trench coats, gray trench coats. I mean, it was just something that was just all out of place. And those were actually supposed to be unmarked police officers that were just in the presence. And like they said, with the shoot to kill order that they had, and like they said, they wanted Troy to actually sit in the middle of them because they didn't want anything to happen. But I mean, it was just something just so very frightening, just for someone to see, you know, all of this that's going on. And like my mom had told them, she said that Troy did not do this. And she told him she wanted to go in her house. And they told her, no, you can't go in your house. We're going to kick your door down. It was just so just frightening just to see. And it just seemed like every officer that was on the police force, if there was an available officer, it seemed like everyone was there.
And it was clearly, you know, meant to send a message so much more broadly in Savannah and throughout wherever people could hear about it. I mean, a message that was sent to a whole section of people that it's us and you, and this is what happens to you.
Let me remind listeners again that we're talking today with Jen Marlowe, who is the co-author of the book I Am Troy Davis, along with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Davis himself. We're also speaking with Kimberly Davis, Troy's sister. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be rejoining our conversation with Jen Marlowe and Kimberly Davis. So stay tuned.
1989, 2009, 2009. I'm innocent.
Innocent, not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty. He innocent, not guilty.
Free Troy Davis. Wow.
For 20 hard years he been wrongly accused. I'm talking about Troy Davis, let me bring you the news. I had a dirty DEA, broke all the rules. Spent a lot of spun the game to make sure you lose. If you pick up the paper and you check the news, they don't got mad at me, I ain't broke no rules. I'm just talking out loud about your backdoor caper. It's court documented, so these facts on paper. So let's get it straight, I ain't scared of y'all. Martina showed the proof on the news at the hall. So now it's time to sit back and take that fall. I got a big mouth and I'ma tell it all. How you mapped out your artwork, your frame and all. You retire while you're still giving Chisholm a call. Got a question for you, you a man of mouth. You're getting mail from an eyewitness to your house. Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty.
Free Troy Davis. Wow.
Not guilty. He innocent.
Please free Troy Davis.
Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Welcome back. That's Free Troy Davis from E-Red. We're talking today with the co-author of the book I Am Troy Davis. Jen Marlowe is the co-author along with Martina Davis Correa and with contributions by Troy Davis himself. And we're also joined by Kimberly Davis, Troy Davis's sister. Now, Jen, when I read the book, I kept thinking about, okay, there's a coincidence. There's a series of coincidences that Troy happened to be at the pool hall. He happened to be with people who knew the guy who has later pointed out and actually admitted that he had killed it, Cole, Red Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Troy happened to be in the area when the gunshot went off. He happened to run. And I kept thinking as I was looking at this and thinking, okay, coincidence. And then I remembered something that Robert King had said to me, one of the Angola Three.
Mm.
Reading his book, and we were talking about his book at one point, and he said, well, yeah, you know, the thing is that people keep coming up and saying, well, it was just a coincidence that you were. And he says, but the problem is coincidence is something that happens to black people all the time. And that really struck me about the whole character of it didn't matter whether it was Troy. It didn't matter whether it was coincidental, because this is just the way routine runs.
Absolutely. And one of the most striking things I remember Martina telling me in our process of interviewing, she was talking about a comment that one of her attorneys made to her that was reflecting not the attorney's point of view, but the attorney was talking about the state's mentality. And the attorney said, you know, this is Georgia, and in Georgia, any black man will do. It wasn't so important that it was the right man, but that they had someone, and someone who just in terms of how society values lives. I mean, how many? There's so many different ways in which we can talk about how the lives of black and brown people in our society are systematically and systemically devalued. And the criminal justice system, of course, is one big piece of that, but not the only piece.
Right, exactly.
I want to comment on that because I can remember, like you said, they had the shoot to kill order on Troy. And Sylvester Coles, if anyone knew Sylvester Coles, growing up, Sylvester Coles was selling drugs, I think at, like they said, at the age of like 13 years old. We actually knew the Coles family, but Sylvester Coles was always known to carry around a gun. The police, when they interviewed Sylvester Coles, they never once asked him about his gun. And the police made a big mistake when they just took Troy's name that Sylvester gave them and just ran with it. And then as things began to unfold, they realized that they made a mistake, but then they could not go back on that mistake that they made. And they just tried to build a bigger picture around Troy, but then everything just started to unravel. But like you said, you know, they just wanted a person. They didn't care whether it was the right person or the wrong person. They just wanted a person to suffer for killing one of their own. You know, like with Sylvester Coles, his criminal records had actually just been just wiped clean. Because like they said, Sylvester Coles, he was known to be a drug dealer. He was in and out of juvenile ever since, like, he was, I think, like the age of 13 years old, in and out of juvenile. And I can remember when we went before one of the parole board hearings, and the private investigators that were with us in Atlanta, we had gotten a call from one of the officers on the police force in Savannah that stated that they had arrested Sylvester Coles for carrying a concealed weapon and also for drug possession. By the time they got from Atlanta to Savannah, which is only like 3.5 to 4 hours, when it got down to the police department or the county jail, there was not a Sylvester Red Coles even booked into the county jail. But yet still, one of the arresting officers actually called us and told us that Sylvester Coles was arrested. When you look back at the criminal record of Sylvester Coles, I mean, you cannot find anything on him. Whereas with Troy never had a police record. And the police, like I said, they made a mistake and they just continued to try to keep it up. And like they said, Sylvester Coles, if he was arrested for drug possession and carrying a concealed weapon, driving under the influence, why was he still not in the Chatham County Jail when the detectives got to Savannah?
And of course, I think what Kimberly is referencing is we don't know, we may never know the details of what kind of backdoor deal was made when Sylvester Cole said, oh, I can tell you what you want to know, right? And to me, it seems pretty clear that Sylvester Coles would offer up that information because he wanted to make sure that he was going to be protected. And so if he could finger someone else, then he would be protected. So what deals were made in terms of what kind of immunity he would get? We can only speculate about that, but it certainly seems very, very likely that there was some kind of backdoor deal that was struck that in exchange for giving over a name. And some of the things that you were saying about the coincidence about, you know, where the places Troy had been that night, I don't think it is unreasonable that Troy would have been among the people who were questioned because he was at the scene of the crime. And so it's reasonable that they would question him and want to know more. That's not the issue. The issue is that once Coles gave Troy Davis's name to the police, there became tunnel vision on Troy. And it became not about let's try to find the truth of who did what that night. But the question began, now we have this name. How can we find what we need to build a case against him?
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Kimberly Davis and Jen Marlowe. And Jen is the co-author, along with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Davis, of the book I Am Troy Davis, and it's about the case of Troy Davis and the fight against capital punishment. And Kimberly is Troy's sister. Now, Jen, it's very much tied into the whole point around, look, what you have today, and I was thinking about this, just thinking about the Jordan Davis case in Florida. What you have today is you have a huge swath, you have a huge percentage of the prison population being young black men,
yep.
You know, and 50%, at least more than 50% being black and brown. The mass incarceration, you have the justification and whitewashing of these racist murders, whether it was Trayvon or Jordan Davis or whoever. You have the systematic police murders of people that just are carried out with just like abandon right now. Mm-hmm. And you have all of this coming together. And it forms this kind of basic, I mean, or you look at even the population of death row, you know, and how overpopulated it is with black men, you know, in terms of percentage wise. And you look at this and it really does speak to this point of all of these things are not just separate things, but there actually is a slow genocide that's being unleashed against black people. And how does fit in with them picking Troy? And once they picked him, there was a lot of other things that came into play there, including the legitimacy of their system. For if they were to have backed off at any point, the legitimacy of everything they have set up would have been called into question. And I was going to ask you about that because in particular, when I read this thing, and as I was saying, when I read the section on the 2010 evidentiary hearing, and I'm looking at that and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, there's no way they can do this. There's no, you marshal all of this
this evidence that was proof positive of the man's innocence, that a frame-up had happened, and yet it didn't matter. Let's talk about, help give people a sense of some of the key evidence there. I mean, I was thinking in particular of what's it, Benjamin Gordon?
Ben Gordon, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was a very heavy scene. And the way this stuff was so just easily dismissed.
Well, and I mean, I think in your question, you've kind of identified a lot of pieces of the answer, right? I mean, all of these things is part of a system of racial control. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, right, where she talked about, okay, so slavery was the initial form of racial control. It was replaced by segregation. And now what we have largely through the criminal justice system is the new version of racial control. And I very much think her analysis on that is spot on. What you were saying with Troy's evidentiary hearing, I think, is one example of that. All of those years, all of the appeals, everything of that, none of that was ever looking at the evidence of innocence. It was always about procedural process. It had to do with, oh, were the recantations submitted to the court in a timely enough fashion, and all these different procedural things. The only time Troy ever got a crack at his evidence actually being looked at was not until 2010, when the U.S. Supreme Court ordered there to be a federal evidentiary hearing, which happened in a federal court in Savannah, Georgia. But an evidentiary hearing is not a retrial. In a retrial, first of all, you have a jury and you have the presumption of innocence. And in a trial, you are innocent and the burden of proof is on the prosecution, innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Troy never got that. What Troy got was an evidentiary hearing in which he was presumed guilty, and the burden of proof to prove his innocence, he had to clearly and convincingly prove innocence, and that burden was on Troy and Troy's attorneys. And the task of proving innocence is a very high bar, especially everyone always asks, well, couldn't DNA help? Well, no, because DNA can only help when there's DNA, when there's physical evidence. There was never any physical evidence linking Troy to the murder. So there was nothing for DNA to be able to overturn. And at this evidentiary hearing, there's not a jury. It is a judge. It was Judge William Moore. And this judge is entrenched in the old boy system of the South. Kim talks about this all the time. The judge had social relationships with the prosecution, with the head of the police. They're all part of the same network. And evidence, very compelling evidence, was placed in front of this judge. Four of the recanting witnesses came forward and talked about the police pressure, the police coercion and intimidation. A witness who came forth, and he had never revealed this before, and he was, Benjamin Gordon, was agonized about whether or not to reveal this, because Benjamin Gordon is a relative of Red Cole's. And for him to come forward and testify as to what he saw, which is that he saw his relative Red Cole's pull the trigger and kill Officer McPhail, he knew he was putting himself at great risk. The judge heard all those witnesses, and then the judge heard the police witnesses. And the police said, of course, no improper questioning happening. Of course, there was no coercion and intimidation. Our investigation was flawless. And then the judge has to choose who he finds credible and who he finds not credible. The judge determined that the very same witnesses who were credible enough for their testimonies to land Troy on death row now all of a sudden were a bunch of degenerates and liars, and their recantations, the judge determined unilaterally, were not credible. And it's all part and parcel of that same system that you were talking about.
Yeah, and I just want to comment on that, because with, like Jen said, we had the witnesses that actually recanted their statements at the evidentiary hearing. But when you had the witnesses that were recanting their testimonies, you had Judge William Moore sitting on this bench with his eyes closed as if he was asleep. During the same time that the witnesses were recanting their testimonies. And then it was almost like an intimidation tactic from him, because you had one other young lady that Kiana. She actually had, I think she had oral surgery that day. And, you know, Judge Moore, he was like, well, you know, I can't hear you. If I can't hear you, then how do you want me to, you know, listen at your testimony? So it was even intimidation tactics from Judge William Moore. But like, it was like when we came into the evidentiary hearing, when the people that were in the audience was listening at the recantations of the witnesses, and, you know, when we went on break, everyone said the same thing. They don't see how this judge cannot give Troy a new trial. It was just the same thing. They're like, they have the evidence in front of them. And then you had one of the lead detectives. He said, well, I can remember the 1970s. I can remember the 1990s, but I really can't remember some of the 1980s. What do you call it? Earl timers. And so, you know, he was on the stand, you know, making jokes. They were making mockery, you know, of my brother. But like I said, Judge William Moore, it's like he had a closed mind. When he came into the hearing, it's like he had already made his own decision that even though we had witnesses that recant their testimonies, he didn't want to hear those witnesses because he had already came up in that evidentiary hearing that he was not going to give my brother a new trial. Because when you had the witnesses and then when the attorneys have so much time to present their evidence and then you have the judge continuing to break in on the attorneys as they're presenting their evidence, is as if he didn't even want to hear it.
You also had jurors who said, if we knew then what we knew now, we probably wouldn't have said guilty. And that was just tossed aside.
Yeah, the exact quote from Brenda Forrest, one of the jurors, she said, if I knew then what I knew now, Troy Davis would not be on death row. In fact, the verdict would be not guilty. That's a direct quote. And she's one of several jurors who came forward. And this was part of the clemency appeal in Troy's 2011 clemency application that there were jurors that were saying, for our sake, don't go forward with this execution because we are going to have to live the rest of our lives knowing we sent this man to death row and now we think we were wrong to have done so, and that's going to be on our souls and our conscience. And it brings up, you know, I often talk about the human impact of the death penalty system and so many invisible victims that we don't see. You know, we focus a lot on the pain of the murder victim's family, the person who was originally murdered, and of course their pain has to be recognized, and of the condemned prisoner. What we don't often see, though, is for many murder victim family members, they talk about how the death penalty actually injures them more and causes and deepens and prolongs their trauma. It doesn't help them. It doesn't bring back their loved person. It drags them through this process that is re-traumatizing and re-traumatizing. We rarely see the families and the loved one of the condemned prisoner and how this impacts them. And we almost never think about what's the impact on, say, juries, like Brenda Forrest had spoken about. And there's actually been studies done, and they show that jurors who are faced with determining whether someone should live or die, that increases their stress, that increases their anxiety. What about the corrections officers who are given the task of having to take a prisoner under their care and kill that prisoner? There's many wardens former wardens of death row institutions, including right here in California, Jeannie Woodford, who is the former warden of San Quentin, who have come out strongly against the death penalty, partly because of the traumatic impact it has on public officials whose job it is to kill our prisoners. Many invisible victims.
Let me remind listeners again that we're talking today with Jen Marlowe, who is the co-author of the book I Am Troy Davis, along with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Davis himself. We're also speaking with Kimberly Davis, Troy's sister. Now, here's another thing that I was really, really glad to see you bring out in the book, because it's a statement that rarely gets remembered. And that is, I think it was the first evidentiary hearing that Troy was given?
There was only one evidentiary hearing. Okay. There were several clemency hearings.
Okay. Well, the evidentiary hearing, when the Supreme Court ruled that they had to give that to him, and there were two dissenters, Thomas and Scalia. And Scalia made this statement, which was just mind-blowing. And people forget this way too often because it says a lot. It concentrates a lot. He said, this court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial, but is later able to convince a habeas court that he is actually innocent.
Absolutely stunning. So according to Justice Scalia, and fortunately that was in the minority, that was a minority opinion, it's not unconstitutional to execute an innocent man as long as he got a fair trial.
You raised this in your book. You raised the point, too, that because what's at stake here? At that point, for the people, what was at stake was Troy's life. And bigger questions in terms of the whole death row and the death penalty. But for the system, what was at stake? Again, the legitimacy. They couldn't turn their back. They had put so much. This is it. This is the way it's gone. It's been proven. There was all these things. Let's just get it over with. Come on, right. You know, all this. And if they didn't do that, the base, the foundation begins to crumble.
finality over fairness. And it goes back even much before Scalia's statement, but the court case McCluskey versus Kemp. And in McCluskey versus Kemp, the Supreme Court actually acknowledged that racism infects every aspect of the criminal justice system, especially sentencing. The Supreme Court acknowledged in this case that sentencing in the death penalty absolutely is racist. But then they said, but we can't really do anything about it, because if we did, it would, you know, the whole system would basically, I mean, I'm not, this is not an exact quote of the Supreme Court hearing, but that, you know, it's too pervasive and it would be too disruptive, I believe is the word they use. So we can't really do anything about it. So they acknowledged, the Supreme Court has officially acknowledged racism, especially in sentencing, but they've said it's so rife throughout the system that we just can't do anything about it. And I think it's the fear of really having to dismantle the system, which is what it needs to happen, right? There are no quick fixes. There are no little tweaks that is going to make our criminal justice system actually uphold the idea of equality under the law.
And in my opinion, to dismantle the justice system, in order for that to happen, you have to dismantle the whole damn system, which is the whole point. We have time for one more question.
Okay. I just want to make a comment about dismantling the system. The system in the state of Georgia, the city of Savannah, Chatham County, needs to be dismantled. Because, you know, for 17 years when Troy was on death row, you had one warden that actually said that Troy was a model prisoner. He used Troy's time on death row to help other inmates. This warden actually wrote a piece to the parole board asking them not to execute Troy. But then you had Warden Humphreys, who came aboard. When Warden Humphreys came aboard, his first time coming into the prison, he told Troy, he said, your celebrity days are over. He said, I'm going to make your last days on earth a living hell. Troy could not understand why would the new warden come to him with this. But the day that Troy was executed, Warden Humphreys came to Benjamin Todd Jealous, the former president of the NAACP. He asked Ben, he said, do you know who I am? Ben said, yes. He said, you're the warden of the prison. He said, no, do you really know who I am? And Ben asked him, he said, well, who are you? He said, I was a police officer on the streets of Savannah back in 1989 when Officer McPhail was killed. I was involved, not directly, but I was involved indirectly. So the Chatham County, in the state of Georgia, they had this all set out because they knew that they had messed up. They knew that they had actually convicted the wrong person, and they knew the only way for them to keep Troy quiet was to go ahead and execute him, because there was no reason why Warden Humphreys should have been at that prison where Troy was. And for him to even tell Troy 3 weeks before we had gotten a decision from the Supreme Court, for Warden Humphreys to come and tell Troy that you already have an execution date coming up, they had already planned this. Like I said, it was already premeditated. They had already knew that they were not going to give him a new trial.
Okay, we have time for one more question, and this is a big one. What I wanted to ask is, as people know, Troy was executed September 21st, 2011. And what emerged from all of that wasn't a collapse into despair, but a movement that actually was dedicated to and on fire about stopping the death penalty, seeking justice. And also, you know, pointing out still, I would imagine, still saying, you know, look, you're fighting to get people to understand that Troy was innocent and this is what happened. But it's a bigger question. But a figure in the middle of all that who was very important and who has figured very largely in your life and in your life was Martina. And I'd like people to know about her and about her role in this, and just tell people about Martina Davis. It'd be very, very important for people to know that. So I'll let you guys figure out who's going to speak first.
Well, Martina, that was, you know, actually my older sister. And like she said, you know, she was actually her brother's keeper. Throughout her battle with breast cancer, you know, she was actually given 6 months to live, and she surpassed 11 and a half years. And it was her determination, her life goal, to make sure that her brother was going to be off death row, to make sure and to prove his innocence, to go around the world and shed light on the injustice in Georgia. Martina, she was a true warrior for justice. And like I said, she was not only there to help Troy. She was there to help anyone she can, because, you know, even though we had our brother on death row, my sister was actually the president of an organization called Georgia Cure, where people that were actually other inmates, for whatever, you know, their convictions were, their family members used to write to my sister asking her for help. She was always out there reaching out to help the other man. And like I said, this is a bigger picture. It was not just about Troy. And it's a bigger picture for us not only to help Troy, but to help anyone that we can. And Martina actually did that.
There's not really a whole lot to add except just to echo what Kimberly said. Martina Davis Correa was a human rights warrior. And, you know, she passed away December 1st, 2011, and she was buried on December 10th, which is very fittingly International Human Rights Day. I think every single, you know, Martina used to say often, and she said it to me often, she spoke about how anyone who met Troy walked away with an imprint of Troy on their souls. But what Martina would never have said, because she was far too modest to say it, is that everyone who ever had the absolute honor of struggling side by side with Martina had Martina also imprinted on their souls. And I think for so many of us who are doing this work, we're doing it inspired by, in honor of, and in solidarity with, and because of Troy, and also Martina Davis Correa and Kim and the entire Davis family. There's nothing I feel more proud of than feeling, proud is the wrong word, but more certain about than knowing that I will do anything I can to be in solidarity with them and with their struggle. And yes, it's about Troy, but like Kim said, it's much bigger than Troy. And it always has been for Troy and for Martina.
All right. I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Let me remind people first that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and our guest today have been Kimberly Davis, who's the sister of Troy Anthony Davis, and Jen Marlowe, who's the co-author, together with Martina Davis Correa and Troy Anthony Davis, the co-author of the book, I Am Troy Davis. Thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
You have been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And this is the part of the show when I get to say, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I also want to thank my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to follow me, you can on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a piece, a little bit more from E-Red and Free Troy Davis. Talk to you again next week.
They never interviewed Reverend Johnson before. See, Troy didn't run, but they ain't wanted you to know. See, normally when you're poor, man, your money moves slow. But when you're rich, you know the press gon' print some more. And they gon' try to make it all racial, so it's not about that for you, quote me, no. The highest power working if you didn't know. And faith takes work, so on we go. Never had evidence or a witness before. They recant statements, they ain't scared no more. Yeah, it's wrong till it's right, we gon' stand toe to toe. How you gon' take a life when you ain't even show? It's gonna take everybody, so my gift, I'm giving it. And Troy coming home is the only way we ending it.
Please free Troy, baby.
Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty. He innocent.
Free Troy, baby. Wow.
Not guilty.
Please free Troy, baby. I'm innocent.
Not guilty.
Free Troy, baby. Wow.
Innocent, not guilty.
Please free Troy, baby.
Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty.
Free Troy.